ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Somewhere in the lonely silence of the solar system, the Europa Clipper is on its way to investigate a beautiful icy moon of Jupiter's called Europa. This is the largest spacecraft ever built by NASA. It looks like a bundle of technology and machinery flanked by two huge wings. Europa is fascinating to scientists and to people like me because it has water, which forms a thick crust of ice on its surface. And having water, scientists think maybe, just possibly, Europa might also have life swimming below all that ice. Tracy Drain is here today. Tracy is the chief engineer at NASA of this mission. She's an aerospace engineer who's worked at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab for over two decades, working to develop spacecraft that boldly go where no human has gone before. Tracy is in Australia for Brisbane's World Science Festival, and she's also a National Geographic Explorer. Hello, Tracy. Welcome.
Hello, Richard. Thanks for having me.
What does it mean to be a National Geographic Explorer?
You know, it's really cool. I have just learned that National Geographic Explorers are not only people who are out on the savannah looking at lions with the giant cameras. They can also be storytellers like me who tell people about the riches of our solar system and other things that you might not have imagined.
I think space missions, this is just me, but I think the space program reflects all some of the very, very best human values. You're the chief engineer of this program, the Europa Space Clipper mission. Tell me about its mission objectives. What are you all hoping to achieve by sending this spacecraft out towards Europa?
Right. So Europa Clipper is a mission that had been a gleam in the eye of scientists for over two decades, people who have been really deeply curious to go and investigate this moon of Jupiter, which is a little bit smaller than our Earth's moon. But as you mentioned, scientists have very strong evidence suggesting that there's a large amount of water underneath this ice shell, more than all of the Earth's oceans combined, times two. And so engineers like myself have worked for many years. I personally only joined the mission in 2020, so I'm a relative newcomer to the team, to build a spacecraft that can support a suite of instruments that can study things like how thick the ice is by ground-penetrating radar and what the composition of the surface is, what kind of chemicals have landed on it, maybe from geysers that have come up through the ice or that have just been brought there by comets billions of years ago. We're also trying to study the temperature of the ice. There's a thermal camera that lets you see areas that are warmer than others. Maybe the ice is a little bit thinner. In general, scientists are trying to determine whether the moon is capable of supporting life, whether it has the right chemistry, the right amount of energy, that it's been there for long enough, that kind of thing.
Now, I know the mission objectives require projecting X-rays onto its surface and all kinds of other things, but I'm so there for the holiday snaps. Is it taking snapshots and actual photography of the surface of Europa as well?
Absolutely. There's going to be a really lovely camera there that'll let you see much more close-up, in-detail images than we ever have of the moon before.
Why does this spacecraft need to be so big?
The spacecraft needs to be so large because it needs to generate enough power from its solar arrays to power all of the instruments and also to keep it warm. There's only 4% of the light available at Jupiter as there is at the sun. And so we have these enormous solar arrays. If you took the spacecraft with its solar arrays unfurled and stuck it on an NBA-sized basketball court, the edges of the wings would hang off the edges of the court.
So is this how Europa is able to travel such a vast distance? Because it's got to go past, what, Mars? That's not a hop, skip and a jump. That's quite a long way. Does it need more than that to travel, the solar arrays to travel that vast distance?
Actually, the thing that gets us all the way out to Jupiter is more about the rocket that we use to launch off of the Earth and get out of the gravity well. So we had the spacecraft fold up its wings and sit on the top of a SpaceX Falcon Heavy launch vehicle, and that gets you going fast enough, but not actually enough to get all the way there. So we had to play the game of solar system billiards where we went out and did a flyby of Mars to pick up a bit of velocity, and then we're actually coming back by the Earth on December 3rd of this year to get another gravity assist to give us our final kick to get going far enough out to Jupiter.
Really? So you've shot it out. Mm-hmm. It's going to do a slingshot orbit around Mars. Orbit? No, you wouldn't say that.
Not quite orbit. So no. You think of it this way. Here we are at the Earth, and Mars is also going in its orbit around the sun. You just have to go close enough to Mars, like gray raise its sphere of influence from a gravitational perspective. And so it's almost like as you get closer, gravity acts stronger. So it's almost like you're holding hands with the planet and it's going so fast that it slings you and then you get a bit faster. And so that makes our orbit bigger. So we're in a bigger circular orbit, but then not circular, elliptical, but then you come back by the Earth if you time it right and you play the game with calculus and physics to know where the planets are going to be. So our orbit is kind of in a little elliptical orbit, and then we went by Mars. It puts us in a slightly different elliptical orbit, and then you head by the Earth, and that gets us in an even bigger one so that the end gets you all the way out to Jupiter. Sorry, your audience cannot see what I'm doing.
But I can picture it, though. So you do this one loop. And you pick up a huge amount of speed from that. And you can do this bigger loop that touches around the Earth's gravitational
field. Exactly right.
And then off to Jupiter.
To Jupiter we go.
Okay. What's the biggest engineering challenge then in building a spacecraft that can get near that great big ugly behemoth that is Jupiter? When I say ugly, I mean it really is beautiful, but I'm talking about the way it treats its neighbors and the like. What does it mean? What are the big challenges in building a spacecraft that can actually exist and function anywhere near Jupiter?
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about power. One of the reasons why we have those giant arrays, because it's so far away, you need to get a lot of energy if you're going to be solar power. But the other giant challenge is the radiation. Jupiter is such a marvelous place. It is huge. It's made mostly of hydrogen and helium. You can fit 11 Earths across the center of Jupiter. And the thing that makes it a particularly challenging neighborhood is because that hydrogen is compressed under its own mass. There's so much of it. And as you get deeper and deeper and deeper into the planet, it gets compressed into a liquid. And as you get deeper and deeper, the pressures and temperatures are so intense that the little electrons that go around each hydrogen atom get squeezed right off. And so inside of this liquid metallic interior, you have free-flowing electrons, and that makes an electrical field. Now, Jupiter, even though it's so big, it rotates really fast. Here on Earth, we rotate once every 24 hours. At Jupiter, that giant planet rotates once every 10 hours. So you're rotating this monster electrical field. And if you remember your high school physics, a rotating electrical field generates a magnetic field. And there are all sorts of other things going on inside there with convection and the way that the fluid's moving, but that magnetic field is gigantic, and that traps charged particles coming from the solar wind and also from one of the moons, Io, that's spewing out volcanic stuff all the time. Those things get trapped in the magnetic field lines, accelerated at near the speed of light, and go crashing into the aurora in the north and south pole of Jupiter. So this makes a donut of electricity, that's the technical term, or a donut of radiation around the planet. And if you send a spacecraft there, you have to deal with that. And the way that we have dealt with it traditionally on a mission like Juno, that I also had the privilege to work on for several years, you orbit Jupiter, but you mostly try to stay out of the radiation zone. So you go in, if you're studying the planet Jupiter, you go in very quickly and take all of your measurements, and then you get the heck out of there for a while. That's how Juno does it. For Europa Clipper, Europa, the moon, orbits Jupiter inside that radiation donut. But instead of trying to orbit Europa all the time and just bathing in the radiation constantly, you orbit Jupiter and you go flying by Europa to take a bunch of images once every 2 to 3 weeks, which is what we'll do when we get there. And so part of the way you deal with it is by staying out of it as much as possible. But when you go in relatively frequently, like we will, you need to put shielding around the sensitive electronics, like the computers and other components for the instruments, in order to take down the level of radiation they'll see on a regular basis. And there's many other things.
Well, I was just thinking that as you were saying that, if I put a powerful magnet near my laptop, which is right next to me, it'll just blitz it, won't it? It'll wipe it out. So you've got incredibly sensitive devices on board there. Mm-hmm. What kind of shielding do you have to have on it to protect it from the massive fields that are being thrown off by the planet Jupiter?
What we use on Europa Clipper is an aluminum vault in order to protect the equipment. And, it's not super thick. Can't remember off the top of my head, maybe half an inch, maybe less. Google is your friend. Go look. I'm sure it's out there. In order to take the environment for the radiation inside the vault down to a level that's more manageable. It becomes more like the environment at Mars, which we're very used to designing for.
Now, as an engineer, you're trained in the effects of gravity on the surface of the Earth, the conditions that we often describe as normal. It sounds to me you're sending a device into a place where nature becomes extremely weird. Do you have to have like a special weird science consultant or is that you? Are you that person that is kind of aware of all that weird science? I just wonder if that's inherent in your job or do you need to have experts around you?
We definitely have to have experts. In order to make a mission like this, it really takes a village. You have a lot of people who are specialists in a variety of areas. We have people who are specialists about even just the electromagnetic environment and how we have instruments on board that are trying to measure the magnetic field, and the spacecraft itself, because it has circuits with electricity, makes a small electromagnetic field. So one of the things, if you're looking at an image of the spacecraft, it has this very long boom sticking out one side that has magnetometers on the end of it, and that's to get it away from the magnetic field that the spacecraft is generating itself. So there are lots of specialists in a variety of areas. Me as a systems engineer, my job is to make sure all of the different aspects of the spacecraft work together, drawing on the knowledge of the experts in those variety of areas and the experts in the different spacecraft components like telecom and thermal and propulsion and all of that good stuff.
If something goes wrong, if you have Apollo 13 moment on it, for example, there's no humans on board this craft, so it's not a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. But if you have something that goes badly wrong, is that the moment when you wake up in the middle of the night because there's a chopper on your front lawn, Tracy? They're flying you to JPL headquarters to come and fix it. Do these things have the ability to self-repair? I mean, what happens when something goes wrong?
Yeah, well, luckily for me, JPL is only 15 minutes drive away, so no helicopters for me. I mean, is that lucky? I don't know. That would be fun. There are a lot of things that we build into the spacecraft so that they do have smarts to take care of some situations. They're so far away. Jupiter is far enough away that a radio signal traveling at the speed of light will take 50 minutes to get there and then 50 minutes to get back. And so we can't just joystick the thing. It has to be able to deal with some circumstances that come up. And so we have, for every component that the spacecraft really needs to work in order to stay safe, there are usually two. There are two star trackers that it uses to figure out what its orientation is in space. There are two inertial measurement units, which is kind of a dead reckoning thing. If you're walking across a room and you close your eyes and you take 10 steps, the reason you know how much you've moved in space is kind of your own inertial measurement, right? We have units like that, two of those, and a variety of things like that. So for the spacecraft, it's programmed so that if X happens, do Y. If Z happens, do B. And it can swap components if something's wrong with it. But it can get itself into situations that are too complicated for it to know what to do. And so then it'll power off everything it doesn't need, point its antenna at the Earth, and go into what we call a safe mode and essentially say, you know, help. And then after enough time goes by for us to see the signal, we on the ground get to do the mystery game. Okay, what happened? Why did that happen? What can we do about it in order to get the spacecraft back on track?
Now, Europa, can you describe what it looks like from the pictures we already have of it?
If you look at an image of the moon, you will notice that it is much smoother than our moon's surface or many of the other moons that are around Jupiter. And that's one of the clues that scientists had that something is going on there that is resurfacing the moon on a relatively recent timescale. I just heard our lead scientist, Bob Pappalardo, say that they think the moon has been resurfaced as recently as 60 million years ago, plus or minus, times two.
Did you say recently?
That's right.
Seriously.
Time of the dinosaurs.
Right. Because our moon is pockmarked and cratered and because it's rocky in its surface. But does that suggest, given that we know Europa has an icy surface, mm-hmm. that it's somehow melting and reforming to make it smooth again?
Or that the ice is cracking and that water is upwelling and then filling in the surfaces? Something like that they believe is happening. One of the reasons why scientists think that there is a lot of water there is because an earlier mission called Galileo studied the Jupiter environment with its magnetometer, and it noticed that Jupiter's magnetic field lines are bent and warped around Europa. And scientists know that here on the Earth, our oceans bend the Earth's magnetic field. You can see it happen when the tides go in and out. And that's because they are conductive. And so you end up getting an interaction with the magnetic field. And so when scientists think about, well, Jupiter is so far away from the Earth, there's only 4% of the light out there, it's really cold, how could there possibly be water there? The story goes, as the moon is orbiting Jupiter, Europa's orbiting Jupiter, its orbit is not quite circular. So sometimes it's closer to Jupiter, sometimes it's farther away. And many people know that when you're closer to something, gravity is stronger. When you're farther away, the gravity is a little weaker. And so that's like as the moon goes around, it's getting squeezed a little more and then released and squeezed and released. And if you ever took a paperclip and bent it back and forth until it breaks and you feel the end, it's really warm. And that's because of the friction of molecules moving together when they are deformed like that. And scientists think that's what's going on inside the moon Europa, and inside where it probably has a rocky core, that squishing and releasing is creating enough heat. They call it tidal heating, in order to melt a lot of the water under that frozen cap of ice.
See, I've seen images of its sibling moon, Io, which looks like hell on Earth. Mm-hmm. Io is like a sort of a molten chunk of rock. And that's because it's being squeezed by Jupiter's gravity like a tennis ball, pretty much.
You got it. Same thing.
And, but the thing that makes Europa different, you're saying, is that it has water, which keeps, like, what, I don't know, melting and refreezing around it. So it looks smooth and kind of looks fine on the outside of all this. So one of the reasons why it's so exciting that Jupiter has water, I know you're not a bioscientist, but this means that there just might, there's a possibility that life as we know it could exist below that. Does that even, I know that's not your field, but does that excite you, Tracy?
Right, not my field. And we like to say, just to be scientifically careful about it, is that the moon has the capability, may have the capability.
Yeah, I know.
Trying to get me fired here, Richard. No, I know.
This is my words. I'm saying it just might, it could possibly be. It probably doesn't, but there's the tiny possibility
there could be. Support some kind of life. Yeah. And the thing that I think people are looking for is there's this lovely, very hard to pronounce acronym that I've learned called CHINOPS, which is carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, sulfur. That if those elements are there and you have water and you have some kind of energy source, which might be the tidal heating coming from below, and also the weak sunlight and radiation coming from above, the combination of those things could potentially be viable for life. And for me, as a normal human out there, I find that very exciting and super tantalizing that scientists are trying to go and investigate.
Well, I'm allowed to hope for alien fish. I'm not a scientist. Alien fish, it's look, it's not impossible, is it? It's not impossible. Will you accept that?
I have no comment.
Okay. All right. Okay. So if we can imagine then Europa to some extent being a bit like some kind of, I don't know, frozen ice creamy treat with a kind of a frozen something gooey underneath that and fluid. Does it have a hard center? It's got a hard chocolatey center, if you like, a rocky center to it. Do we know that, or can we know that?
I think I have heard that scientists believe there is a rocky core. This is where my own particular science is a little bit fuzzy about that. And I'm not even sure how much Europa is going to learn about that. I know that our ground-penetrating, ice-penetrating radar is going to go down fairly deep. It'll tell us how thick the ice is. It'll give us a sense of the depth of the ocean. I think perhaps the magnetometer will teach us a little bit more about the entire makeup of the inside. I think there is a rocky core. I'm not 100% sure.
So what's going to be the path of the Europa clip? Is it going to orbit around Europa, or is that not even possible?
Yeah, sadly, no. Orbiting around Europa would expose us to way more radiation than our spacecraft is designed for. So we're going to orbit around Jupiter. And in the beginning of the mission, every 21 days, we will fly by Europa and take a whole bunch of measurements with our suite of science instruments. And then almost midway through the mission, we will shift down to every 14 days flying by. So over the course of 4 years, we'll do about 50 science flybys.
What do we know about the weather systems on Jupiter? And is that a factor for you as well?
Oh, good question. We are actually going to be high enough above the clouds of Jupiter that it's not going to affect the spacecraft. We really just treat it like one big massive planet in order to keep our trajectory in the form that we want it to be. But I know a little bit about the weather on Jupiter because I spent time working on the Juno mission, which has been in the Jupiter system since 2016, also orbiting Jupiter in a much bigger orbit about every 53 and a half days. Going by and taking a lot of measurements of the planet there. And we know that Jupiter, it's just gorgeous. When you close your eyes and think about what you've seen in school books of Jupiter, you see these lovely tan and kind of orange and a little reddish cloud structures, and then the huge great red spot that we all know about. And what I learned is that the darker bands that you see are actually deeper in the clouds than the lighter bands. And one of the reasons that the scientists know that is the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 impacted with Jupiter in 2009. And it was broken up as it came into the system and as the individual pieces went in. Unfortunately, for us, at least in the United States, when we had telescopes that were watching Jupiter, the impacts happened on the backside. And so you had to wait until Jupiter rotated around. And then you saw where the comet pieces came in, these dark bruises of this like dark, rusty, almost dried blood, dare I say, color on the surface. And my understanding from the scientists is that as these big chunks of comet went in, going punching into the atmosphere, they got deep where the pressures were high and the temperatures were high, and they kind of detonated and exploded this darker material up onto the clouds. And so I learned that if you imagine looking at Jupiter as a three-dimensional object, the darker bands are deeper inside the lighter bands.
One of the pleasures of talking with people like you who do have an extraordinary job is to find out how you got from there to here. You were born in Louisville, Kentucky in the United States. Tell me about the family home for you as a little kid. Who was in the family home with you?
Yeah, so my earliest memories really are me living with my mother, my brother, who's 2.5 years older than I am, and my grandmother. So I was very fortunate to have two moms for a while until my mom remarried when I was about 10. And then it was my mother, my stepfather, myself, and my brother.
Was the system smart enough to figure out that you were clever? Was it smart enough at the time to go, were there teachers who took your mum aside and your grandmother aside and said, Tracy's actually very, very bright? Were there signs early on that you were like that?
You know, I was very, very fortunate that when I was in first grade, I actually got in trouble a bit for talking way too much in class. But my stroke of luck was that my teacher, rather than saying, this is a problem child, please get her out of my hair, sent my mother a full one-page handwritten note in 1982 that essentially says, Mrs. Williams, my mother's maiden name at the time, your daughter will not stop talking. I asked her to stop talking. I put her in a corner. She talks to herself. But near the end, it says, I think she's bored. She finishes her work early and she doesn't know what to do with herself. So next year, why don't we put her in some more accelerated classes? And that really did change the entire trajectory of my life.
How supportive was your mum of that, of you taking on that much ambition for yourself?
She was so supportive in everything that I've ever done. It's hard to even express how grateful that I am to have a mom who was like that. She herself didn't like super duper love school. She loved history and some elements of school, but she kind of ran screaming from school and was kind of done with that world and wanted to have her family and have her job and live, you know, air quotes, normal life. But she always thought it was cool that I was interested in school, and she always bought me books and exposed me to different things, got me piano lessons, like everything to kind of broaden my horizon.
Were you always aiming for the world of space?
Always. And not quite always. When I was very young, I was interested in a lot of things. I liked to dig around in my grandmother's backyard to see what buried treasures there might be. So for a hot second, I thought I might be an archaeologist. I loved arguing with my brother. I thought, well, maybe law is a thing for me. I went through a variety of things when you're a kid and you're imagining what you would want to grow up and do. But when I started thinking seriously about the fact that I'd have to have an actual career in order to pay the bills, what could I do that would keep me interested for, you know, for decades? And definitely the world of space was going to be it for me. And then it was just about, well, what kinds of things can you do that involve space that you can have a career in?
Okay, this is the toughest question I'm going to ask you today, Tracy. For you as a kid, when you had to choose between Star Trek, Star Wars, and Battlestar Galactica, which one was it for you?
100% Star Trek. Star Trek all the way. Yay. It wasn't even a hard question, Richard.
Why Star Trek?
I like Star Trek. And I don't know if I was aware of this back then, or if it's one of those things that you think about later and then you have malleable memory, right? But I like that Star Trek The Next Generation was very much about exploring new worlds, new civilizations, and doing it in a way that was very peaceful and trying to use creative problem solving in a way that didn't always resort to violence. And for me, that was kind of the big draw of Star Trek. That and having so many different people from different civilizations working together in order to solve problems and go off and explore. So Star Trek all the way.
I never thought about it like that before. I suppose Star Wars is all about one man who saves the galaxy, isn't it? But Star Trek's about a group of people working together to solve problems, which is the reality of the kind of work you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
You come from an African-American family. You're African-American yourself. I have to ask, was Lieutenant Uhura a thing for you?
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. And I didn't even know until I was much older. I had an opportunity to meet Lieutenant Uhura, Nichelle Nichols. She came to the lab. That's one of the benefits of working at a place like that in 2016. And she told me the story, and I told my mom, who told me another story, which blew me away. So Nichelle Nichols told me that she, after the first season of the original Star Trek, was going to leave the show. And then she met Dr. Martin Luther King, who essentially, I'm paraphrasing, said, "Are you crazy? You have no idea how important you are to have kids all across the country see an African-American woman in this really key role on this amazing TV show." And so she decided to stay. I told my mom this. And my mom said that one of the reasons that she even is interested in science fiction is that their older sister, Juanita, looks a lot like Lieutenant Uhura. And so they would rush home to watch the show, and that's what got her interested in Star Trek in the first place. And the reason that she watched, or the fact that she watched Star Trek and Star Wars and all the things, she passed that along to me and my brother. That's why I'm interested in this, and that's essentially why I have the job that I do today.
So once you settled on mechanical engineering, how did you then find your way to the space program, from Earth to the heavens, if you like?
There are so many strokes of luck for me. I studied mechanical engineering at the University of Kentucky, and then while I was at University of Kentucky, they encourage all of the engineering students to go get a job while you're in school, get an internship, get a co-op program, we called it, in order to get a taste of what it was like actually having your job. And I walked into the co-op office. And because we're in Kentucky, I expected the options to be companies that are building construction equipment or printers. Lexmark Printers is there. But I had someone come up to me and say, so what do you want to do? I'm like, well, I want to work for NASA. Ha ha. But tell me what you got. Well, it turns out they had a contact at NASA Langley Research Center in Virginia and said, we can try to get you set up with a phone interview. And I'm like, that would be great. So they did that, and I talked to someone on the phone for about half an hour. At the end of the call, she said, I think you'd be great. Can you start in May? And it took me a second, covering the phone and freaking out for a second. Yes, please, that would be great. And so that's how I got my first foot in the door at a NASA facility. And once you go do an internship at a NASA facility, at least back then, it was easier to come back. So I did a fall and then a summer and then a spring and then a summer and got to meet students from all over the country. So after that, I went to Georgia Tech for 2 years to get a master's in that. And the Jet Propulsion Laboratory was one of the many NASA centers and companies, aerospace companies, that came to the career fair at Georgia Tech interviewing students. So I bumped into a recruiter, drooled all over them. Please hire me. I would sweep your floors. Thanks. And they let me come out to interview at the lab, and I got hired right out of grad school.
So does that mean, as an engineer, you're an engineer who's got to specialize in extreme gravity or lack of gravity and that kind of thing? Does that change all the parameters of engineering when you're a space engineer?
Yeah, I think it's not quite as cut and dry as that. So I studied mechanical engineering, which is how you get things to move together in order to accomplish some kind of goal. And when
they've got to bear weight, though, don't they, these things, very often, don't they?
Yeah, you can think about it this way. There are lots of forces that act on any machines. Like, here we are sitting on this chair. If you're in your car, you're sitting in the car, and as the wheels are turning, there's a force of friction against the wheels. And so gravity is just another force that happens to act in the same direction with the same amount of force if you're at sea level everywhere on the Earth. And so from an engineering perspective, it doesn't feel that special per se. But then when you are designing things in space, you just need to know for your design, subtract that force once it's out there. But then you have to have a spacecraft that gets through the challenging environment of launch, which has even more G's than when you get out there. So yeah, somehow that particular piece did not strike me as being overly complicated. I think the thing that's hardest when you are developing things to operate in space are all the other things that you kind of take for granted on the ground that aren't there. Like when you put something in a vacuum, not only do you get to not worry about pressure acting on it, but regular materials like rubber and plastics will outgas, and they will release things off of their surface that can then land on other things like your optical instrument. Oh yeah,
that's really? A big deal. You mean like plastic can sort of very, very, very faintly start to disintegrate without air pressure on it? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, some types of plastic, sure. Yeah. And so you have to be very careful about what materials you use. And they won't just outgas forever until they go away, but they might just outgas a bit, but enough to put contaminants on your optical instrument that can be a problem for the things that they're trying to measure. So we have specialists whose whole job is about contamination control and understanding the materials that we're using and what that means about outgassing and what we have to do to keep things warm and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah.
I've talked about this in this program before. One of the moments I remember so vividly from my childhood in the 1970s was when the paper landed on our front doorstep. And it was one of those rare occasions back in the 70s when they had a colour front page of the newspaper, and it had photos of the surface of Mars. Mm. It was one of the first Mars probes to land there. And I just remember thinking of how much it discombobulated me and excited me and enthralled me that we could see the surface of Mars, that red, brown, pebbly surface, the craggy mountains, the dirty atmosphere with the pale sun in the sky. That blew my mind. Was your imagination similarly stimulated by some of these photos that have come from the space probe missions?
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly for me, the most vivid image that I have is not really even from the later ones, but it's from when I was in second or third grade and I first read the story of how the solar system was formed and knew that scientists could kind of figure out, based on what they could see today, that we must have been formed from a giant cloud of dust and gas that came together under gravity and other little forces that created the sun and all of our planets. And just that whole idea of us being able to figure out where all of this came from was fantastic to me. And even just artist conceptions being drawn in the book about that are kind of seared into my brain from early childhood.
You did end up working on some of the Mars missions, overflight of Mars, if that's what you'd call it. Mm-hmm. Tell me what they revealed about the surface of Mars.
Yeah, the very first mission I got a chance to work on when I came to JPL as a baby systems engineer was the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And its job was to get to Mars and then go around in a science orbit for many years. It's actually still there and operating today. And it had a bunch of instruments on it in order to examine the atmosphere and to examine the surface. And some of the things that I thought were particularly cool are the images that it's taken of these. If you imagine a wall of a crater that had rivulets that almost look like the tracks of water may have been going down inside. And because I've been off that mission for a very long time, I do not remember if they determined whether those were really streaks of briny water or if they were very, very fine sand that had been disturbed by the winds and then flowed down and made patterns like that. But I know that they have seen lots of evidence, as previous orbiters did too, of ice at the poles. People always say, well, is there ice on Mars? Well, scientists know there definitely is at the poles, carbon dioxide ice and also water ice. But one of the things that people are interested in is how much ice there might be closer to the equator, where it's easier to land heavy things like people with payloads.
Are there moments when you think, oh, for God's sakes, build me a spacesuit and a craft so I can just go and poke it with a stick myself so I can see myself?
Actually, no. This might be me getting a little bit too old. I have no desire to go out there myself. Super happy to have other people go and to build a spacecraft to go take instruments there.
Yeah, zero gravity and the vertigo is a bit of an off-putting thing for me to the thought of that. Now, tell me about the Kepler Space Telescope, the mission you worked on there, what that was looking for.
That is such a fantastic spacecraft. Its whole job was to go and find exoplanets, which are other planets inside our galaxy, outside of our solar system, around other stars. And the way that it did this was very elegant. There are lots of different ways that you can detect other planets, but the way Kepler does it is by looking at the light coming from a star, and if you detect very faint dimming of that light, and if that dimming happens at a repeatable frequency...
Oh, something's passing in front of it?
Something's passing between the Kepler Space Telescope and the star. And if it's a repeatable frequency, then that could be a planet, or it could be a companion star. So the scientists have to be very careful and figure that out. But it was looking at a field of over 100,000 stars all at once in its field of view, and then measuring that the brightness of the light and those and that dipping. And over its mission, Kepler has discovered, oh my gosh, it's been a while since I've looked at the numbers, but a little bit under 3,000 confirmed planets.
That many?
Wow. That many. And here's the thing that's amazing about that. If you were to go outside in the night sky, hold your hand up, the area that Kepler was looking at was about the size of the palm of your hand against the night sky. And so if scientists can then extrapolate from the planets that it found, you estimate that there's probably 100 to 200 billion stars with planets in our galaxy alone.
I read a while back an article about the idea that there might exist dark planets, planets that have somehow come loose from a star, that are just floating cold and dark alone in space. Was Kepler able to even detect those if they're not reflecting any light?
Right. Unfortunately, Kepler cannot detect those. Those are rogue planets. And when they studied in school and then read articles later about how solar systems form, sometimes the structure of them can be a little bit fragile when you're arranging them. There's a game out there, I can't remember the name of it, where you could try to build your own solar system and you can set the mass of the star, you can set the mass of the planets, you can try to put them at different distances, and you'll find that it can be a little challenging to put them in places that are stable. And if the planets go, you know, too close or the wrong angle from the sun, they just get like flung out, like they're doing their own little gravity assist. And that's where these rogue planets come from. They're just out there doing their thing. Again, me, engineer, not scientist. So it's possible they also come from other things. I'm going to make something up right now. I'm making this up. So
okay.
Go check to Google. If the star goes supernova, I don't know what happens to the planets on the end, or if the star turns into white dwarf. Maybe there are other ways for a rogue planet to form, but that's the way that I know. And you're right, since they're not near a star and going around it in a repeatable fashion, for Kepler to measure that dip in brightness, Kepler cannot find rogue planets like that.
From my learned point of view, I'm pretty much sure that's where Thanos is hiding out, from one of those those planets. That's just my inexpert opinion, though. Once you designed the spacecraft, you and your colleagues designed the Europa Clipper, this huge thing that's as big as a basketball court, as you said, you've then got to figure out a way to fold it up, like make it collapsible and stick it in the nose cone of that Falcon rocket you were talking about. You compacted it somehow, like a bit of camping equipment in the nose cone of this rocket. You shoot it up, the rocket out through the gravity well of the Earth into space. Mm-hmm. What happens when it comes out? Does it sort of come out like a butterfly from a chrysalis?
Yeah, that's actually not a bad analogy. So we definitely, the being able to fold up the solar rays is an integral part of the original design. If you imagine sticking your arms out to the side, if you had about three elbows and you could fold your arms in very nicely, that's how it happens. And we had long conversations about when you fold it up and you have the cells that are on the outside, should those be the cells that are power producing, or should you fold it so that the power producing ones are on the inside in case something happens to hit them? Like, do you protect them or do you need to make power? Like, there's a whole bunch of trades that are like that. Ours, we did power side out, so that if somehow it took longer for the arrays to deploy than we thought, you had some power while you're trying to figure out what's going on. And this is one of the pieces where the spacecraft needs to be autonomously set to do all the things. We have very large batteries on the spacecraft, unlike some missions where you could launch and you'd only have like a couple of hours before you had to get the arrays out or you would run out of power. We had many hours, I think something like 19 hours, because we're here at the Earth and cells are out. But at any rate, you have the spacecraft folded up. It's in the nose cone of the rocket. You launch the rocket, and we're all like on the ground with our hearts beating very, very fast.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Are you one of those people in that room with a headset?
Absolutely.
That's you in that control center?
I was actually, at that time in the mission, I was the mission manager for like the last year going up to launch. And so it's a little bit weird because you have this title that sounds really gigantic, but you have no duties in that room. It's the people who are out there, the flight director.
Yeah, but people are going to want answers from you pretty quickly if something goes wrong.
If something goes wrong, yes, I was definitely going to be in the hot seat. And also, as you're going going up through the countdown to launch, the mission manager has a responsibility to check in with the flight director and everyone and make sure things are going well and give the thumbs up to our project manager who's down at the Cape with another part of the team. So you're there. That day is very exciting and horrifying. But you have your spacecraft on in the nose cone, and then it launches, and it takes some time for it to like get all the way up through the atmosphere enough so that you can open the fairing and expose the spacecraft, because you don't want that to happen while you're still going through air. It can be damaging to the equipment. So once you get up high enough, the fairing opens, the spacecraft separates. And this is kind of adorable that in this day and age, you can have cameras inside the fairing. And so when the fairing opens and there's light in there, you can actually see the spacecraft as it's still attached to the rocket. And for whatever reason, we were all so busy in that last year, like hilariously sleep deprived. I did not remember that we were going to have a camera in there. And so in our mission support area, when we were playing the news feed just like everyone else's, as well as our headsets on, talking to each other and talking to the people down at the Cape, you see the light in there and the camera on the spacecraft. It's so like your last view of your baby as it's going to be leaving the Earth. And then it gently separates, and then you can see it start to spin up because it needs to do that to not get too hot from the sun on one side. So we're in our little barbecue roll as it's on its merry little way out into space. And then it has to, it has pre-programmed routine on board to know that once it gets to a certain rotation rate and it gets stabilized and then it slows down and then it sends out the solar arrays very slowly. And now you can't see it anymore because the camera is just on the launch vehicle, and that is coming back to Earth. And so we are just watching all of our telemetry in order to see indications that there's sun on the arrays and you're getting the right amount of currents that you're supposed to see and all of those things.
I completely understand how you might say it feels like your baby sort of coming out of its womb and into the world. What feelings can you allow yourself in that moment, and do you necessarily feel? To me, it sounds like you're someone like who's composed a symphony or something. Mm. And, you know, you write it, you sit down there and you work on it and you do all the notation and the orchestration. But then you're going to sit there on opening night and watch it do its thing and mm-hmm. watch it unfold. Is it like that? Is it joyful or sad or what?
Oh, you're feeling all the feels. It's definitely all the things. I think especially because even the launches that look on the outside picture perfect, there's always something that's going on behind the scenes that is a little bit nerve-wracking. And so you're definitely full of joy that you got off the ground in the first place. One of the things that was, this is going to be a slightly longer answer, that was particularly crazy about launching Europa Clipper is that there was a hurricane that went right over the Cape. Like, right, you couldn't have aimed it any better on the day we were supposed to launch. We were supposed to launch on October 10th. Hurricane Milton, direct hit over Cape Canaveral. We still had the spacecraft inside of the vehicle assembly building. Luckily, now that we have weather forecasting, we knew the hurricane was coming, so we didn't roll out. We sat there, and then they evacuated almost everybody from the Cape, and we're in Pasadena in our control center, like sweating bullets about our baby spacecraft. But then the hurricane goes by, NASA sends out teams of people to go check out the facility, make sure everything's okay. Luckily, we get the all clear. Holy cow. A couple of days later, we roll off the spacecraft when we take off on October 14th. My birthday, by the way. Yay, happy birthday, Tracy. Got a baby spacecraft. and so we are intensely relieved just that we were able to launch the thing. We're so happy that the launch vehicle has performed well. Everybody is like deep in their procedures, checking all of the things we're supposed to see from the telemetry. And also, you know, as mission manager, in the back of my mind, we're thinking, are we on track? Everyone's been in this control area for hours. When are we supposed to like feed people so that they can keep their brains working? Once we get to the point where the spacecraft has done all of its autonomous things, and now it's time for us to really take over. So there's so many excitement, stress, fear. There were a couple of things that happened in the last minutes leading up to launch where these incredibly professional people on the launch vehicle team were saying that there had been like a thermal anomaly that they were working, like we're working our procedures. And those of us are in the control room, like staring at each other, like it's 120 seconds to launch. What is happening down there? Because at some point you reach a time where if you have to scrub, you have to like take all the fuel out of the launch vehicle, and it takes another couple of days in order to reset and be able to launch again. So we were like, are we really going to go today? What's happening? And it took them down until, I want to say 45 seconds to say that it was clear before we lost. So we were all like about to pass out, but still on point to do your thing once the vehicle gets off the ground. So yeah, it was pretty crazy times.
We're speaking in late March 2026. Where is the Europa Clipper right now?
Clipper right now is actually on its way closer into Earth than it has been. So we launched the spacecraft in October 2024. It gets going in this fairly large orbit so that we could go past Mars, do a Mars flyby to steal some of Mars momentum and get going a bit faster. That puts us in an even bigger orbit, but on a loop such that we come back by the Earth in December 3rd of this year in order to steal a little bit of the Earth's momentum and get going even faster on our last leg all the way out to Jupiter.
When is it expected to arrive?
We're going to arrive in April of 2030. So, yeah, strap in, bring some snacks.
And it will orbit Jupiter how many times?
I think over the entire mission, because of the way we have to use the gravity of Jupiter to set up for the Europa flybys, we're going to orbit a total of something like 75 times, but there will be about 50 flybys of the moon Europa.
And once it's completed its mission, where will it go? Will it crash into Europa or into Jupiter?
Yeah, good question. So usually we don't like to crash into Europa because that is a place that might be habitable for life, so we don't want to contaminate it.
Of course.
And in the past, there have been rules saying that, you know, you shall not unintentionally or otherwise, crash into Europa.
So, and is that just in case someone's left the tiniest bit of bacteria or a skin cell on it? Is that
it? You got it. Just in case there's the tiniest bit of contamination and in case there's any way that something from the surface of the ice could get down into the liquid below. Now, since then, we've done lots and lots of analyses, complying with the Planetary Protection Office, which is an actual thing, and to determine how long it would take something from all the information we know today to get down to the surface. And so I think that theoretically we could deorbit. We don't like to say crash. We say plan deorbit onto Europa. But that's so far out the end of mission. Like, I haven't even personally been paying attention to what our plans are there yet. Somebody knows, but not me personally.
You don't have a supervillain ambition, Tracy, to leave some of your skin cells on it so you could give rise. You could be the progenitor of life on another world.
Hilarious. No,
no.
That's not my thing.
The Voyager missions were sent out with all these lovely things inscribed on the spacecraft. If it happened to be found thousands, millions of years, however many billions of years later by some extraterrestrial civilization, is there anything inscribed on the Europa Clipper?
There is. Inscribed on Europa Clipper is this really beautiful plaque that has a poem by Ada Limon about how we are all water. It's like this connection that we have to Europa. We humans come from the sea, and we have a lot of water on our bodies. Europa's made of water. And it actually has this really beautiful illustration, I guess you would call it, that is inscribed what the sound waves look like of people saying water in many different languages, and including one that is representative of American Sign Language.
Do you have the best job in the world, Tracy Drain? Do you feel like you have the best job in the world?
I have often felt like I've had the best job in the world because I grew up as a kid who really liked puzzles and learning new things and discoveries. And as an engineer, my job is to figure out how things work together, figure out how to fix them when they don't. So it's all about puzzles in service to discovering new things in space. So, yeah, I really have enjoyed my job a lot over the last 2.5 decades.
I think it may be about every once in a year, every couple of years or so, the thought pops into my mind of the Voyager probe, which has now left the gravitational effects of the sun, hasn't it? It's gone beyond that into
interstellar space.
Interstellar space. And something about, it's silly, but part of me feels for its loneliness or something like that. It's a servant that's completed its mission for us and will now leave this planet, will never return. But I just wonder if you have, do you lie in bed at night sometimes and think about your baby, the Europa Clipper, going out into space, never to return?
I do. You know, it's interesting because maybe we're so used to communicating digitally with things these days, even communicating digitally with other humans who are on the other side of the world through our telephones. And we communicate with Europa so often that in a way, it doesn't feel like she's very far away. We have our little names. We call her Clippy when we're talking about Europa Clipper. And when are we going to have our next contact with Clippy and how's she doing and what are we seeing and all the telemetry? So in a way, it still feels intellectually very close, even though in physical distance, she's very far away.
It's been wonderful speaking with you, Tracy. And thank you so much. Live long and prosper. Tracy Drain, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a delight. Thanks for having me, Richard.
Let the record show we're both making the live long and prosper hand gesture to one another. Yay! As we speak. Tracy Drain is in Australia as a guest of the 2026 World Science Festival in Brisbane. Today's conversation with Tracy Drain was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Jennifer Leake. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.